Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We have the honor this morning of broadcasting live from the Sullivan Museum and History Center on the campus of Norwich University in Northfield. Today is the second day of the Norwich University Military Writers Symposium. The theme of this year's symposium is Global Conflict or Cooperation, Evolving Arctic Security. Throughout the morning, I'll have guests who are distinguished symposium speakers or honored guests. And here to start us off is Sam Alexander. He's a board member at Gwich'in Council International and an adjunct faculty member at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Program. Sam Alexander, I want to thank you for joining us on Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Great to have you. Sam and I will be discussing the Arctic security and resilience from the indigenous people's perspective. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Sam a question about this, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Who are the Gwich'in?
So the Gwich'in are the northernmost American Indians. We live in Canada and in the U.S. About two-thirds of us are in Canada and about a third in the U.S. Population probably about 9,000, and we span an area, you know, probably like the size of, you know, maybe Texas. Mm-hmm. So we need a lot of land to roam, so
that's where we're at. Well, you grew up in that culture, and you did roam. You know, that's part of your DNA. So tell us what it was like growing up in that Gwich'in culture.
You know, it was I look back now, and I recognize how very fortunate I was to grow up where I did at the time I did because of the amount of freedom we had to be out on the land and to, you know, to learn from our elders and from our, you know, from our parents and to go out there and have those experiences, just being on the land. And I think it was, you know, I lived down here in the States for a bit. When I became an adult, I was down here in the States.
And you attended Dartmouth, too far from us.
Yeah, I went to Dartmouth for graduate school. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think the big thing was this, is that it was a community and that you had responsibilities as a community member. And as a kid, you learn those responsibilities. And as an adult, I think I have a, you know, a little bit more appreciation for trying to be a good community member and making sure that I'm meeting my obligations to my community. And so I wasn't a part of a community when I moved down here in the States. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of a little bit of a jarring experience. And it took time to become part of a community as I was down here. You know, there's some great communities down here, obviously. But I didn't know what my role was within the community. And so it took time to learn that.
Oh, interesting. Now, living in Vermont, you know, we think we understand, you know, growing up in an environment of long winters, but I'm guessing there are some serious challenges that you face living up in the Arctic.
There are. So I grew up in a community that's off the road system, and so it's kind of a funny concept, but I don't know if there's communities here in Vermont where you can't access them by a road. So there's a lot of communities.
Those are a lot of people who don't want to be accessed.
there's some outlier communities there.
Right.
I grew up in a small community is on the Yukon River, and so the only way to get to Fort Yukon is you can fly there, or you can go to where you can drive to the Yukon River. There's only two places to get to the Yukon River, and this is a like 1,900 miles long river. Mm. So there's two places you can go to get to the river. And so you get to the river, and then I would take a boat to my hometown. So, like, I'd drive for, you know, a couple hours, get to a place, put my boat in, and then drive my boat for a couple hours, then I get to Fort Yukon. And so, you know, anything you try to get done is just, like, one step further logistically. And it's the logistics of it really. Right. Like, I was building a house a couple summers back, and I didn't have, like, the right screws. And so I had to call the city, and I had to ask a friend. I was like, listen, you got to go to the store, buy these, put them on the plane, and get them to me. Because that was it. I had no choice. You know, I was stuck where I was at. And so, you know, the planning and the logistics, you really do have to think about every eventuality or every possibility to be prepared and to be, you know, situated in a good place, you know, to survive.
How'd the house turn out?
The house is great. I still have like Tyvek on the side of my house. I don't even have I still haven't put on the siding yet. So it's, you know, but it's warm though, so that's all really matters.
Has the culture, the Gwich'in culture, changed in your lifetime?
It's changed quite a bit, and part of that is, you know, we've shifted from a subsistence economy, which is, you know, very land based. When I was a kid, there was a lot of trapping still, and so people would go out and they'd go trapping, and you could make a living as a trapper when I was a kid.
Right.
And you know, as an adult, that's just not a pot. You just really can't. And so the amount of time people spend on the land is quite a bit less than it used to be. And also, a lot of our language has been substantially impacted by you know, Western society for a lot of reasons. But there's not as many speakers of a language now as there used to be when I was a kid. Like, when I was a kid, you'd hear, like, elders speak. And that's all they spoke, in fact.
Right.
Some elders wouldn't talk, really speak English. They just, because they just knew the language. And so I grew up, I actually lived with an elderly couple. My parents, they sent me to live with these elders in a smaller community than I grew up. I grew up in a town of 600 people, which was considered a big community.
Wow.
I was sent to a smaller community, about 120 people. And I lived with this elderly couple. And the old lady didn't speak English at all. She never spoke English, and she couldn't read or write. In fact, whenever she got, like, a check from the government, you know, like a pension check or Social Security, wherever it was, I had to go with her and witness her signing it. And she put an X on there.
Oh, no.
She couldn't write. And so that's what I grew up with, was I grew up with people, you know, that are from a very, very different culture than, you know, contemporary America.
Yeah, so that's how the culture has changed. How about the environment in the area?
Great question. The environment has changed. Well, so I was just up there a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. I was up in Fort Yukon with my kids, and when I was up there, the river wasn't frozen over. Now, this might sound funny here, you know, here in Vermont. I mean, you're like, well, wait a second. It's only, you know, it was only October a couple of days ago. Yeah, but this is Alaska, and the river should have been frozen by this point. But the ice had just starting to run, so it's just starting to freeze. But it was 35 degrees when I was there on October 31st. When I was a kid, when you went trick-or-treating, it could be 40 below zero. And so for us, you know, when it's 35 degrees, that's just too warm. And the thing is that, you know, when we think about climate change, a lot of times people are like, well, you know, the temperature is going to warm up by like a couple degrees. That's not a big deal. But where it becomes a big deal is when you go from 31 degrees to 32 degrees, when you go from frozen, you know, when you're going from freezing to melting,
right,
that 1 degree, that's the place where there's a problem. And for people in the Arctic, we need the cold. The animals need the cold. That's what we're built for. And so surviving on the land is actually a lot easier when it's cold. It's really difficult to be on that, like, margin, or to be on that, like, shoulder where it's freezing, you know. Yep. Freezing, thawing. That's not a good place to be. You want to be where it's frozen or it's not.
Right.
So
what are, other than that environmental concern, global warming, what are the greatest concerns of the Gwich'in about, what do they have concerns about their native lands?
One of our biggest concerns, well, it's food security is a great concern of ours.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, really, really high up there, because we have two real big sources of stress for us when it comes to food security. One is with the porcupine caribou herd. There's been this push for many years to drill with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Right.
And so we fought against that because we recognize the impact that's going to have on the caribou, because it's right there in the birthing grounds of the caribou. And so they have a really short window for their calving. And so it's like 2 weeks. And in the very limited spot, and that's the exact spot where, you know, there's an interest for drilling. And so we've been fighting against that for years. And our elders put forth a mandate, you know, and gave the direction to our leaders that we have to protect this place. And so that's one of the big fights we've had. We've been fighting that for years, and we've built allies and really done our best to ensure that we protect the porcupine caribou herd, because where that herd goes, as you know, it's not just that calving ground, but they traverse this large area. And if you were to look at the Gwich'in territory, it aligns with the ground, the where the herd moves, and that herd brings life to wherever it is. It brings life, you know. The wolves need that. The people need that. The animals, the other animals need that. The other big food security issue we have is with our salmon. And so this summer, I'm a subsistence fisherman, and I put in a fishnet. And, you know, this summer, I wasn't able to fish because there are closures on the Yukon. And so keep in mind, we used to have hundreds of thousands of king salmon that would go up the Yukon. This is the richest salmon in the world because they have so far to travel. They store all this fat. And so these salmon, because of this is my opinion, this is Sam Alexander's opinion, because of mismanagement by the state of Alaska, we don't have salmon anymore. There was a complete closure. There's a collapse of the fishery. When they were doing the count this year, they were counting in the tens of thousands. That's nothing. We didn't even meet our treaty obligation with Canada. We have a treaty obligation. People don't know this. We, as the U.S., have a treaty obligation with Canada for a certain amount of king salmon to enter Canada from the Yukon River. They have to be sourced from the Yukon River.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't meet our treaty obligations, again, because of this collapse of the fishery. So people heavily rely on king salmon. When I was a kid, I remember going to fish camps, and people would have thousands of king salmon hanging and drying. And that's what people subsisted on. We had no salmon. I have no salmon in my freezer right now. Zero.
Wow.
That's the first time ever.
Mm. Sam, we're at this symposium here at Norwich University. How does a symposium like this one, focused on evolving Arctic security, help call attention to what is currently happening in that part of the world?
One of the big challenges in the Arctic is that conversations regarding security are very limited. And so the primary place where the conversations about the Arctic occur is at the Arctic Council. So the Arctic Council is an intergovernmental forum where we have 8 members nations. So you have the U.S., Canada, you have Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Russia, and Iceland. And so Arctic issues are discussed at the Arctic Council as a permanent. So Gwich'in Council International is a permanent participant member to the Arctic Council, which basically means that as indigenous people, we have a seat at the table, because about 15% of the circumpolar population is indigenous. And so it's a unique institution in the fact that you have native people at the table. Where there are challenges, though, is one is that the Arctic Council doesn't talk about security. It's one of the things they'll tell you, like, we don't talk about security. And so where do you talk about security? It's a challenge because, you know, we have our relation with Russia as a nation, and because of some of the things that the Russian government has done in the past, those places where we would normally talk about security, they don't exist, or they're not occurring with Russian participation. And so this is a place, though, where we can another venue for us to talk about what does security look like in the Arctic and really allow for a pretty frank discussion about, you know, what do we want to achieve as the U.S. and what are some of the challenges that we have as a nation in order to achieve our strategic objectives in the Arctic.
Why specifically were you interested in speaking here at Norwich University and the cadets of Norwich?
So when I saw the invite for this, I immediately said absolutely yes, I want to be there. And the reason is that the cadets here at Norwich, they will be the future leaders, both in the civilian world and the military world, here in the U.S. That's going to happen. And so what I wanted to do, you know, I thought about, you know, what I know and what could I possibly share with them. And I wanted to impart upon them that we have indigenous people in the Arctic and that they need to be cognizant of that, and they need to seek out our voice, and they need to listen to us as they decide what strategies they want to take within the Arctic. And so knowing that in the future they're going to be making decisions for this nation about our stance in the Arctic, I want them to say, hey, you know what? I remember talking about this and hearing about this from a Native person, and I want to know what they know, and I want to talk to them and see their perspective. Because at the end of the day, you know, when the U.S. loses interest in the Arctic, we will still be there.
That's right.
And so whatever they decide, it's going to impact us. So I want them to hear our voice.
And transversely, you know, how does what unfolds in the Arctic affect the rest of the world?
You know, the Arctic is really, what happens in the Arctic is going to impact the rest of the world, because you think about the Arctic as like the AC unit of the entire world, of the entire globe. And so when your AC unit is broken, you know, the climate within your house gets a little funky. And, you know, you don't like that. You're like, you know, some days it's warm, some days it's cold, and you're like, I don't understand what's going on. And so all of a sudden there's this inconsistency, and you're unable to tell. And I guarantee your listeners have experienced this, where the knowledge that they have of growing up here in this area, all of a sudden a lot of that traditional knowledge that they have, you know, it doesn't work anymore, because they can't anticipate how the weather is going to be, and it's a problem. And so the Arctic is telling us, hey, we're changing up here quickly. And guess what? Those changes aren't just going to stay in the Arctic. This is just the first place that it occurs, and it's going to occur elsewhere, and we need to take this seriously. So, you know, from that perspective of climate change, absolutely. From the perspective of security, thinking about the Arctic, you know, the Arctic, because there's receding ice, you know, there's this idea that there's a rush for resources and it's et cetera up in the Arctic.
Right.
But it is another place where there is potential for friction between nations. You know, there's potential for friction between the U.S. and China because of fishing, you know, potential between U.S. and Russia because freedom of navigation. And so it's just another place where there's going to be more friction than there had been in the past, because you just now, instead of having this ice curtain protecting us from each other, well, that's going to be gone. And we're going to all of a sudden, hey, we're going to rub up against each other.
The Gwich'in people in the Arctic, is there a resentment or a worry that these other people, other countries, lay claim to what is your ancestral lands?
There's not so much a worry amongst the Gwich'in about us losing our ancestral lands, you know, any more so than that's already occurred from these other nations. But there is concern from, I've heard this concern from, you know, from our friends, you know, to the north and to the west of us in Nupak and Yupik regarding the maritime environment. And so, you know, we are not Gwich'in, we're considered American Indian. You know, the Nupak and Yupik are Eskimo, Eskimo in language. But because of the maritime environment and how that is becoming more accessible, there is concern from them regarding, you know, the impacts of ships and et cetera on their food security. We have obviously we still have our food security concerns regarding fish, and I feel like it's only going to get worse because, you know, as we see increased fishing occurring in the Bering Strait and, you know, impacting the fish sources of not only of the salmon, but, you know, the species that they feed on, all of that, that's a problem.
Now, Sam, you're also the founder, CEO of Latitude 66, and you know, you have adventure travelers come there to this remote part of North America. What does that impart on people when they get to see this part of the world and see, you know, what the ancestral people have there and how they live in that land?
I think what it imparts on people is it imparts a few things. But one of them is that you can live in, you know, and then I say this and I mean this, you can live in harmony with nature. You can live in a way that you're not taking more than you should take, and you have a responsibility to be a good steward of the land, of the animals, the water. And so they see that you can live that way without having a like really negative impact. And the other thing is, for people, it's important to unplug from the internet, and you know, from the, and you need to talk to people. You need to be around people. You need to be on the land, and you need to have your mind uninterrupted by things. And I tell you, that's the biggest thing I see. Like the first day, people are like checking their phones, looking at their phones, and like, and it doesn't work. And so I laugh, you know. And then after like a couple of days, and they just really mellow out, and they're like, then they're focused, and they're in the moment, and it's that is freedom. That is what real, and that's what we show them. We show them what real freedom is. The only way to experience it is to break free.
Oh, that's beautiful. Sam Alexander is a board member of the Gwich'in Council International. He's an adjunct faculty member at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Center for Arctic Security and Resilience, and he's a featured speaker at Norwich University's Military Writers Symposium. Sam, this was a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me here.
All right. We're going to take a break for CBS News Update, then we'll return to speak with author Adam Higginbotham. And coming up later today, we've got the afternoon news service, followed by the Brady Farkas Show, and then Dinner Jazz with Mr. Jazz John Wilson. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary, and I'm at the Military Writers Symposium hosted by Norwich University. At the symposium each year, the William E. Colby Award for Military and Intelligence Writing is awarded. Last year, that honor went to Adam Higginbotham for Midnight in Chernobyl, the untold story of the world's greatest nuclear disaster. The book was selected as one of the 10 best books of 2019 by the New York Times as well. Adam Higginbotham joins us now to discuss the book. Adam, it's great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have a question for Adam about his book or the Chernobyl disaster, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. The email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Adam, when did the Soviet nuclear power program get started?
Well, it started immediately after the advent of the Soviet military nuclear power program in the 1940s, and really suffered from the same problems as the Western nuclear energy industry, which is that, you know, all of it was rooted in nuclear reactor design and technology that was originally developed to make plutonium for nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Describe for us what comprised the Chernobyl nuclear power plant.
At the time of the accident, there were four separate reactors, all of the same design, which is known as the RBMK. And these reactors were of a type that was never used for electricity generation in the West. And the RBMK had been developed from as I mentioned, these this military technology essentially that was used initially to make plutonium. But the problem was that the Soviet nuclear industry wanted to Soviet nuclear heads of the Soviet nuclear industry wanted to gear up and scale up nuclear electricity generation using PWR type reactors of the kind that are very common in the West at the time. But Soviet manufacturing technology just wasn't up to it. So they chose instead this much more simple design, the RBMK, because they could build it in regular factories that didn't need special tooling. And they could build them quickly, and they wanted to really get going at the end of the 60s because they'd fallen behind the West in construction of nuclear electricity generation plants. The problem was that the RBMK was faulted from the outset with these deep-seated instabilities and design faults, which laid the basis for the accident at Chernobyl in 86.
Mm-hmm. The Russian supply chain also had problems of its own. What were those problems, and how did that impact the construction of the Chernobyl reactors?
Well, Soviet manufacturing was plagued with problems of all kinds. Partly because of the nature of the Soviet state, which was really riven with corruption and lies in a way that made successful manufacturing of reliable products extremely difficult, because people were presented with, factory managers were presented with these extremely unrealistic manufacturing targets to meet the goals of five-year plans. And nobody wanted to upset their immediate superiors and bring them bad news. So everybody would falsify, the fact that they had met these goals. So you'd end up with the people at Gosplan, who were the economic mandarins who ran the entire system from Moscow, were just sent these figures that were complete fiction, really. So nobody really had any idea of what was going on in the overall Soviet manufacturing sphere. Added to that, the quality of Soviet manufacturing in the first place, the fundamental level, was extremely poor. So at Chernobyl, you had this situation where, as the then Ukrainian Ministry of Energy explained to me, you had this intermediate step in Soviet manufacturing that was not present in Western manufacturing, which is that the technicians who were building the Chernobyl plant would take receipt of the equipment that had been manufactured at plants elsewhere in the USSR, say, a transformer, for example. But then they would have to, as soon as they received it in a packing case, they then have to take it apart and examine it in detail and rebuild it to make sure that it had actually been manufactured as it was supposed to be manufactured in the first place and wasn't full of defects.
Mm-hmm. Which put incredible strain on the timelines that they were expected to meet in building these reactors. Chernobyl itself, it was named after an existing town nearby, but it actually an entire village was constructed to house the workforce of the power plant. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it was an entire city that was built from scratch, just a couple of kilometers away from the site of the power station itself. And it was named Pripyat after the river that flowed past the site. And in common with all other installations like this across the Soviet Union, what they would do is they would build an installation, a power plant in this case, and then they would build a city to house the workers who were initially constructing it. And then after some of it was completed, the workers who would work there and their families. And Pripyat was one of those towns. It was known as an atomic city.
And it grew to how many people?
By the time of the accident, it housed around 50,000 people, but it was projected to grow to be a city that would accommodate 200,000 people because they were continuing to add reactors and expand the Chernobyl plant. It had four online at the time of the accident, but there were two more, five and six, ready to go within the next couple of years. And they had plans to expand it to be a plant of up to 12 nuclear reactors, what they called a nuclear park, which was ultimately intended to be the biggest nuclear reactor complex on Earth.
And Atomkiev, which is a city of, what, about 2 million at the time, not that far away as well, correct?
No, it's about an hour and a half's drive or less if you took the dedicated hydrofoil that there was at the time down the river. So, I mean, Pripyat was what was remarkable about Pripyat is that it was built to attract the best technicians from around the Soviet Union. So it was designed and proved to be, up to the point of the accident, a really wonderful place to live. In contrast to other cities in the Soviet Union, it was extremely well supplied. So in the shops, you could buy delicacies like fresh tomatoes, which were unknown in large parts of the Soviet Union at the time, and 15 different kinds of sausage. It had all these facilities like a yacht club and a disco. It even had a scuba diving club. So it was a really remarkably good place to live for the average Soviet technician who came there, which is one of the things when I began researching the book I found most remarkable about the story is that, you know, if you grew up in the West, you were kind of schooled to understand that living in the Soviet Union in the 80s was just a terrible experience, and everybody who lived there was a sort of, you know, victim of the socialist system and utterly miserable from day to day. But when I began meeting the people who actually lived in Pripyat, you know, that was far from the case. And they made it clear to me that, you know, what they really one of the things that they lost in the accident was that they lived in this, you know, wonderful sylvan location surrounded by open countryside, you know, with a white sand beach by a river, and they really loved living there.
I'd move someplace with 15 different types of sausages and a disco. Before the Unit 4 meltdown, which was April 1986, had there been any other problems with reactors at Chernobyl and in Russia?
There have been problems with the RBMK at RBMK plants all over the Soviet Union, right from the outset, from the very first one that was built in Leningrad. There was quite a serious accident with the first reactor outside Leningrad in the early 70s. And then there was a partial meltdown in reactor number one at Chernobyl itself in 1982. But in common with all accidents in the Soviet nuclear power program, these were all covered up. And the details of them and what caused them, you know, were concealed even from other technicians who worked at other nuclear power plants. And indeed, at Chernobyl itself, you know, the technicians who worked on other reactors, reactors 2, 3, and 4, you know, were not informed of what had happened at reactor 1, for instance. And this meant that, you know, contributing to the structural problems with the Soviet economic system, with the design faults that were already extant in the reactor itself, then, you know, there was no sort of shared knowledge base among nuclear technicians who lived in the Soviet Union. They had to pick up details of what had happened on the sort of the rumor mill, or by, you know, picking up hints about accidents in Pravda. But people were just kept ignorant of the realities of how dangerous these reactors could be in certain modes of operation, which were well known to the heads of NICI at the Nuclear Design Institute, and the, you know, people at the heads of the nuclear industry.
Adam, what occurred in the control room on the fateful night of April 26, 1986, in Unit 4?
Well, what happened was that there was a scheduled safety test that had been postponed, in fact, since the reactor had gone online several years earlier. And the test was designed to test what would happen in the case of a power station blackout. The power station itself was deprived of electricity from the grid, which was necessary to power the emergency pumps that would keep cooling water circulating around the core of the reactor and prevent a meltdown. So they scheduled a safety test, and the problem with the test was that it could only be conducted when they were shutting the reactor down for scheduled maintenance. So it was something they could only do, you know, once every 4 years. And so the pressure was already on to do this thing because it was supposed to have been done 4 years earlier. And when the shift came on in reactor control room number 4 to begin conducting this test at midnight on April the 25th, Friday, they understood that this test had already been conducted by a previous shift, as it had been scheduled to be. So they were sort of unprepared for this to be done on their watch. They just thought they were going to be overseeing a reactor that had already been turned off and was just in the process of cooling. And in the initial moments of this shift coming on, the reactor control engineer, Leonid Toptanov, who was responsible for running the desk of Unit 4, made a mistake, and he began to inadvertently shut the reactor down. And so power inside the reactor began falling precipitously. And it passed a point at which the regulations said that if reactor power fell this low, they should just turn it off and shut it down. But Anatoly Dyatlov, who was responsible for overseeing the test in the control room, was really desperate to make sure this test took place, and insisted that Toptanov, with the aid of another member of the previous shift who was standing beside him, brought the reactor up to sufficient power to keep it going, to get the test going. And so there were other members of staff in the control room who protested about this because they knew that it could be potentially dangerous to try and bring the reactor up to power after it had got as close to zero as it had. But Dyatlov insisted. And so they did everything they could to bring the reactor up to power. But this put an already unstable reactor, because of its numerous design faults, into a state of even greater instability. And it was in that state that they began to conduct this safety test. And really, from that point on, I mean, no one really knows. I mean, I spoke to the guy who oversaw the final investigation into the causes of the accident, and he said that there was no real telling at what specific point it was already too late to turn back without causing a serious accident. And really, it seems that the moment that they took the decision to proceed and not shut the reactor down, it was already too late. So they went ahead and they conducted this test. And the test itself was extremely short. It lasted only 35 seconds. And as far as they were concerned, the test was a success. And at the end of the test, at the end of those 35 seconds, the order was given to shut the reactor down, and then, you know, the thing would be shut down, it would go into a state of cooling, and they could carry on with their maintenance. But after they had shut the reactor down, and they began to see all of these signals coming through on the control boards, on the annunciator panels, warning of something serious happening inside the core of the reactor. And what had happened was that a massive steam explosion was precipitated by the instabilities that had been generated in the run-up to conducting this test.
Now, once this disaster happened, the Soviet government tried to keep the world from finding out about it. What was happening in other countries like Finland that alerted them that something was amiss somewhere?
Well, what happened inside the reactor was there was this massive explosion that tore the top of the biological shield off the top of the reactor and blew the top off the building, releasing a massive cloud of radionuclides into the atmosphere. And these were kind of snatched away immediately by high-altitude winds heading towards Scandinavia. So although the Soviet authorities did their best to keep what had happened quiet, and the KGB immediately threw a cordon around Pripyat and around the power plant to prevent people getting out and transmitting word of the accident into the area around the plant and into the wider Soviet Union, and indeed cut off all the long-distance telephone lines for the same purpose.
Yeah.
You know, the Soviet Union, for all their power of the centralized state, they obviously couldn't stop the spread of this radioactive cloud into the atmosphere. So what happened was that over the course of the next 48 hours, radiation alarms began going off all over Scandinavia. And ultimately, the reason that the accident came to international notice is because a technician inside a nuclear power plant in Sweden, north of Stockholm, began noticing that workers were setting off radiation alarms at the entrance to the power plant before they'd even set foot inside the building, before they'd even set in, set foot inside the reactor space where they could conceivably have been contaminated by their own reactor. And eventually he realized that they were treading radioactive contamination in from the parking lot where it had fallen in rain overnight. And they were able to do an analysis of this contamination and figured out that it came from a nuclear reactor that was open to the atmosphere, and it was of a kind very different from the ones in Sweden.
The book does such a great job in such detail of the work that was done afterwards, immediately afterwards, to try to cover this up, to try to cover the core reactor with sand and lead, the building that was built around it, the sarcophagus. We only have a couple minutes left, unfortunately, Adam, but you've been now to Chernobyl. So what was your reaction? What did you see when you got to go to the power plant?
Well, I went quite a few times, and you know, my initial thoughts were much as you might imagine, but this is partly because I went in the middle of winter the first few times I went. And in winter, it's, you know, it's an extremely bleak, abandoned landscape, blanketed with snow, and you can still see all of these disused power lines with the electricity cables cut and hanging down to the ground. And it just seems like an extremely grim post-apocalyptic landscape, and it's a very frightening environment. But eventually I started going back there in the summer when you can visit Pripyat, and Pripyat has been effectively taken back by nature. And it's now overgrown with plants, and it's populated by wild animals, many of which haven't been seen in Ukraine for decades. And then it seems like a very beautiful and rather bewitching place. It's a fascinating place to visit. I mean, partly because you can walk through the middle of the city and get a sense of what it would be like to be the last person on Earth.
Wow. Oh, Adam Higginbotham is the author of Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. It's the winner of last year's William E. Colby Award for Military and Intelligence Writing, also selected as one of the 10 best books of 2019 by the New York Times. Adam, congratulations on a fabulous book. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning to discuss it with us.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for news. Then we're going to continue broadcasting from the Military Writers Symposium at Norwich University, where next we'll meet this year's symposium fellow. And today at 1 o'clock, it's Greg Hooker, full-blown three-hour version of The Getaway. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, coming to you live from the annual Norwich University Military Writers Symposium. Norwich's John and Mary Francis Patton Peace and War Center has awarded the 2021 Richard S. Schultz 60 Symposium Fellowship to Lorenz Simpkins. He's the class of 23 and from New London, Connecticut. The Peace and War Center awards this annual fellowship, which includes a $2,500 grant, to an undergraduate student for a single project that may involve additional Norwich undergraduate students. The award follows wide solicitation and competitive selection. With me now is Lorenz Simpkins to discuss that project and his nonstop college lifestyle. Lorenz, I want to welcome you to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great to be here. How are you doing?
All right, I'm great. Let's get you up a little bit there. All right, listeners, if you'd like to chat with Lorenz Simpkins, ask him about the project or about life at Norwich University as a cadet, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. All right, triple majoring. I'm not sure I've ever heard that before. First of all, what are your three majors?
Yeah, my three majors are political science, history, and studies of war and peace. So there's a relative level of intertwinedness, if that's a word.
Sure.
You know,
interconnected.
Interconnected. There you go. the thesaurus speaks, right?
That's right. And why did you choose those areas of study?
So I think it kind of comes out in my project why I would choose this too. So, you know, to know where you're going, you need to know where you've been. And so history is, to me, is a foundation of the liberal arts. I think that history and English, I guess. But I think that also, though, wanting to study the future, I think political science gives you more tools for comparative analysis and kind of projections that you would be able to make. It gives you the scientific basis as well, because history is more of the liberal arts end of that. And then studies in war and peace is kind of a middle ground of the middle ground almost. And then there's a national security element to it, which I think is more flexible for the modern times. It's more suited in a way to the modern times. So in my project, I do a historical analysis with comparative political comparative analyses. And then I also tie in the national security element. So this all kind of works. This is like proof in practice of why I would choose these intertwined things.
Mm. Yeah. With so much going on, I mean, how many years do you hope to graduate?
This is next semester is the beginning of my senior year, so I'll be graduating the next fall and be having a good old time.
Incredible. Right? All right. How is being in the Norwich Corps of Cadets enhanced your college experience, or has it?
Absolutely. It absolutely has. I see the Corps of Cadets as it's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. There are definitely great students, great individuals, our civilian component on this campus,
right.
Who might not select this, who might not opt for this. But I think in the fact that we all willingly chose this, you know, nobody forced us. We all have the same stressors. It gives us all a baseline. You know, you can't say your life is more difficult than somebody else's around here, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or you can't say that you're more stressed out than everybody. So it removes that element, that weird interpersonal element. And also, I think on top of that, it teaches you how to kind of not work under duress, I would say, but work within the confines of a schedule. When you're a rook, one of the things you do is you learn about is time hacks. And anybody who's been through basic training as an enlisted man would know what this is. It's, you know, you have 5 minutes to do this, 2 minutes to do that. And these are hard, fast deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that teaches you, that's something you can take into your own life, is that I have deadlines. I need to accomplish this in a set amount of time, you know. It demands a level of attentiveness to one's surroundings, to one's schedule, to the impact your actions have on others as a leader.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different moving parts, as I'm sure you can probably tell just from being here.
How much interaction is there between the cadets and the civilian students here at Norwich?
I think there's a great deal of interaction between the civilians. There's obviously that strange, intangible divide in being there's a military element and a civilian element.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the integration, I think Norwich, insofar as any other military college has had an integration of a civilian component, I think we do it better than pretty much everybody else. And that's that cooperation and collaboration between civilians and military is increasing because, you know, in the classroom, it's just a classroom. It's not the Corps. It's not the civilian world. It's just a classroom.
Right.
In this fellowship, this isn't, you know, I am here as a cadet, but I'm here as the research fellow. Being a cadet is not my principal thing. So, you know, we balance it in an interesting way.
Well, let's talk about that fellowship. What does one need to do or submit to be considered for the fellowship?
So you have to already at least have a kind of idea of what you want to do for your research project, be able to explain it. And the demand, I think, and this is a great thing, is it needs to be something that's either a not so much talked about or kind of an untapped vein of knowledge, you know, an area of pursuit or inquiry that people aren't talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the crux of it. That's the rub of it, really. I think that coming up with something that can, again, be unique, be special, be something that contributes meaningfully. That's how we as students can have a say in this discussion, than we in academics, you know, in the global discussion. You want to take part in it, you know, research something, create new knowledge. And Dr. Morris and the Peace and War Center, they've done a great job of kind of fostering that environment of a kind of continual pursuit, a relentless pursuit to seek new knowledge, to figure out things that are unique and original. But back to the process, yes. Yeah, so you submit that idea and just a statement of intent, and then you go through an interview process. My interview was with Dr. Morris and Dr. Koo. And I've actually had Dr. Koo as a professor before. He's a great professor, and I've had occasion to get to know Dr. Morris, both excellent. And you explain your idea, you explain your academic background, you explain your ability to commit the time and the effort to the project, and then you know, there's a selection process. That's internal. I don't know what goes on in there, you know, the closed door thing. But
well, what is your specific project, and how did you come to find this, and why were you inspired to follow this specific project?
Yeah, so my project specifically is, as you know, the theme of this year's symposium is Arctic conflict or cooperation. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, coming into this project, I guess this is the best way to start it, coming into this project, I wanted to incorporate in some way China. I think it's necessary if we're going to think about, you know, world powers and hegemony and all these things. We have to talk about China in the discussion, irrespective of the region, I think, just because of the diversity of their investments and how many things they have their hand in. So, in talking about the Arctic, I think that's, you could say the same thing about Russia, that you cannot talk about the Arctic without talking about Russia. So, and knowing that we generally talk about the Sino-Russian relationship as one of collaboration, as almost an alliance, not somewhere in between alliance and cooperation.
Right.
I have a different perspective of the extent to which that cooperation is has been fostered and it exists. So I wanted to examine that relationship. I wanted to examine China and Russia in the Arctic. And I wanted to see the extent to which there were conflicting interests between them, because there's opportunity for that. If you look at, you know, China published the 2018 white paper where they called themselves a near Arctic state. They kind of, creation of new kind of categories almost.
And let's just stop for a second, because the geography is that they are not an Arctic state.
Yes.
China is not. So why are they considering themselves a near Arctic state? You know, what does that get them? What's their angle on that?
Yeah. So
please.
No, I mean they justify it
right here. This is worth your fellowship. This answer.
No. So really, they justify it in the next sentence in the white paper. They say because it's a global space and we are an interested party. Mm-hmm. We have extreme levels of interest in the region. We have assets in the region. We have investments in the region. And again, it being a global space where the actions of an actor in that, a regional actor, can impact global trade and the climate, all these things. Their conception of the Arctic as a global space is not incorrect. Now, their special status as a near Arctic state is, I think, what drew the consternation of the other parties. I mean, they do have historical precedent for activity in the region with the Spitsbergen Treaty of 1925, where they have commercial access to the Svalbard Archipelago, which is Norway's sovereign territory. Mm. But it doesn't lend itself to say that they have an interest in the governance of the region, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So. All right. Lorenz, what does it mean to you to have been chosen for this fellowship?
It means the world to me. I'm just really appreciative of the, you know, the kind of trust that's been placed in me as a student, and the kind of, I don't feel any pressure, but I do feel an obligation to live up to the, you know, the amount of work that, and infrastructure behind the scenes that nobody gets to see. You know, the work of Dr. Morris, Nicole Greenwood, who works at Peace War Center, Mira Kim, who's my my advisor for the project. All these people have, you know, devoted time. They have other things to be doing, but they, you know, devoted this time to help me out. So, and to the Schultz family especially, It's again, this is an opportunity. You know, who could say this? You're engaging in graduate level of research as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
You know, and this prepares you for a military career or a academic career. You know, so I'm just appreciative of everything.
Well, you're mentioning other people's time. I'm already tired just thinking about the schedule you must have to maintain. With what we've discussed so far, a triple major, you're doing this fellowship. You also play a sport.
Yes.
What do you play? What sport? What position?
Yeah, so I play rugby for the North University Rugby Football Club. I am a loose head prop, so it's a forward, you know, one of the big men.
Mm-hmm.
For the team.
And he is a big man.
No, not compared to some of the fellows on the team. But, it's my second year playing, and I love every second of it. You know, great team, great guys, because especially with rugby, it's a unique sport in that there's a social element to the sport that's a kind of underlying culture that is as important as the game itself. You know, we're a rugby football club. We're not just a team. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is a brotherhood. So,
now you didn't play in high school. You played football in high school.
Yeah, I played football in high school. Yeah.
And so, what was that transition like learning this sport? Which is the rules are completely different.
Yeah, totally. It was nice because I played a pretty simple position in high school. I was a tailback, so. You know, tailback and a fullback. So my life was really simple. just get hit and run the ball. So,
that's right.
Yeah, but the complexity of rugby and the intelligence required, the instinct you have to develop, is just, it's a totally different animal. It looks like a similar sport if you don't know how complex rugby is in comparison to football, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That transition was not easy. I think I'm physically naturally inclined to the sport, but I definitely had to do a lot of, you know, resetting my mind and unlearning habits that would be good in football that are bad in rugby. You know?
Yeah.
So.
No blocking in rugby. I think the team's like 6-1 right now.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and we're number one in the country.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Have I left anything out of what you're doing here at Norwich? Corps cadets, triple major, fellowship, rugby. Voracious reader.
No, that's pretty much it. I just, you know, again, I would just like to throw out those props to the rugby program. We're going to be playing in the New England Conference Championship against UMass Lowell. So, and we will be winning that game. So,
I like that attitude. When is that? Do you know?
That is, I believe, next week. I'm pretty sure we have a bye.
All right.
I got to check on that.
Right. We'll try to get that on our WDEV Sports so people know about that. And how about reading? You are a voracious reader, so when does your schedule allow for that? I mean, do you do any pleasure reading, or now is it?
Absolutely. Really? I don't discriminate between pleasure reading and academic reading. I'm literally the type of person, I will read a carpentry manual just because I bought it. You never know what you could pick up from, and that's my mother. My mom used to buy me books that were completely out of my a 6-year-old doesn't think about the Overland Campaign during the Civil War or you know, the composition of the Union Army. But my mom would buy me books. She'd any book, you know, just pick it up. I was obsessed with the Civil War as a kid. I don't know why. It's an interesting time in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, like, was the foundations of my academic learning. So I just picked up reading as a hobby. I read whenever I can. Use audiobooks if you have to. Whenever you can and whatever you can. It's not a, you know, if you start delineating between pleasure reading and work reading, it becomes harder to do both.
Yeah.
You know? So
that's a great point. Any favorite authors?
I would say definitely. Books. We'll start with books too. The Sherlock Holmes series. It's my favorite. Marcus Aurelius. I'm a big fan of all the classics.
You are indeed.
Yeah. It's to me the philosophy and everything is kind of what. W.E.B. Griffith, actually, the Brotherhood of War series, which he's part of the military writers, founders of the Military Writers Symposium, is one of my favorite book series. I have, like, there's a lot. I'm trying to think of, like, name one that's, like, distinct to me. Beyond
that's all right.
The
I know I put you on the spot. It's always hardest to think of, you know, that list of books that you would tell people about.
I would say Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. That if anyone's going to read a book, that would be the book to read.
That's fantastic. Yeah. All right. when you graduate, which is next fall,
yes,
you said, what do you hope to do once you graduate from Norway?
So I'm pursuing a contract for a PLC in the Marine Corps. So it's a PLC contract where, you know, platoon leaders class. If I graduate, I believe it's different. It's called OCC, OCS. So it's a 10-week officer candidacy school, and then you go to TBS. And I'm trying to see if I can get a reserve commission. If I can't do that, I'm going to enlist in the reserves and work on grad school stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I know you said that military history has been something you've been interested in. Did you know for a long time that a career in the military was where you were headed, what you really wanted to do?
Yeah, I think so. I come from a military family. My father was a sub guy.
Really?
And, yeah, he cross-rated. He was a corpsman and a sub guy. And everybody in my family, my grandfather was in the Army, my great-grandfather was in the Army, like just all the way back. That's just what people in my family did. But they were all enlisted men. They're all NCOs, so I figured, you know, maybe it'd be nice to do something different, get a commissioned officer in the family.
Yeah.
And education has been always something that my parents stressed, so, I'm always looking to learn more knowledge, and an officer career track is the best place to go if you want to be, you know, picking up academic knowledge while pursuing a career in the military.
Well, you've obviously listened to your parents quite well. What would you tell prospective students, and in particular prospective cadets, about the experience that they'll have coming to school here at Norwich?
I would say our motto, expect a challenge to achieve distinction.
Come on.
I can do better than that. Trust me, I can do better than that. Don't come here expecting anything to be handed to you. That's what I would tell them. Don't come here expecting to, for it to be easy. Life is not easy. Nothing is easy. Nothing worth doing is easy. Being lazy is easy, but, and come here with an open mind and buy into the program early on. Figure out what you want to do. Find something on campus that you want to do, whether it be sports or a specialty unit, or any a club, anything. Mm-hmm. And commit yourself to that, and commit yourself to your studies as well. But come here with a realistic perception of what you're getting yourself into. You know, not in a negative way, I'm not saying that. But,
sure.
This is a Spartan environment. This is not, for the faint of heart. So, come with an honest perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this has been a particularly strange time to be a college student with the pandemic. What effect has that had on your college experience, do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely changed some things. Right? We didn't have a rugby season last year. The confusion that ensues in any kind of catastrophe or whatever you would want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the effect the COVID-19 pandemic has had on me is that I want it to be over.
Yeah.
That's really all I can say. I mean, it's like, I could complain, but we've all been locked up for a year,
Yeah.
So.
How much of your classes had to be converted to virtual learning?
Well, it depends on what time of year it was, because
mm-hmm.
I was home last year, first semester, because there was some confusion with my scheduling and what my status was as a student. And then the next semester, it just didn't make sense to cause the disjuncture and come back in the middle. So all my classes were virtual, so that was a weird experience. But, it's like anything else. You just adapt and overcome, and, and you will excel if you work hard enough. So.
Yeah, and I know some people probably find that more comfortable. Some don't.
Yeah, no, it's not, like I said, in half of it's, I think it's 50% luck and 50% work, and,
Yeah.
And then you see what happens, especially with online learning,
The Schultz Fellowship presentation is this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Will you have any friends or family in attendance? Or?
No. my family works for a living, so it's kind of, they
sure.
Got to work, that's pretty much.
What has their reaction been, though, to you getting that fellowship?
They're proud of me, but they, they expect me to do well, if I'm going to make this investment of going to school in myself, they expect me to succeed, or if not, go get a job,
You didn't think you could squeeze in a fourth major? You slacker.
I'll get a PhD on that, right?
Don't they need somebody over on the football team as well as rugby? Unbelievable, the schedule you're keeping. Lorenz Simpkins is Norwich University's John and Mary Frances Patton Peace and War Center 2021 Richard S. Schultz 60 Symposium Fellowship recipient. Say that fast.
Yeah.
He is triple majoring. He's a member of the school's rugby team and in the Corps of Cadets. I want to congratulate you on everything you're doing, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a break for CBS News. We'll get an update. Then we're going to continue broadcasting from Norwich University. When we return, we'll speak with Troy Bouffard about the Russian Arctic defense strategy. And a reminder that coming up today at 11 o'clock after Vermont Viewpoint, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Troy Bouffard holds a Master of Arts in Arctic Policy and is currently completing a PhD program with a focus on Russian Arctic defense strategy and international law. And he's the director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Center for Arctic Security and Resilience. Troy's taken a hard look at what Russia's more aggressive posture in some areas of the globe might mean in the Arctic. And he joins me now to discuss this issue. Troy, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Listeners, to ask Troy about the Russian Arctic defense strategy, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Troy, how has Russia become a key agitator in global politics over, say, the last 5 years or so?
Well, with Russia's resurgence into trying to become a great power and modernize its military and show the world that it needs to be paid attention to. It's taken the opportunity to do what it often does, leverage the peripheries to demonstrate its resolve, like they're doing in Syria right now. And since Russia is largely in a position now to do this, where they hadn't been for many years after the Cold War, even the United States, we just kind of stopped looking at and paying attention to Russia.
Right.
They're back.
Yeah.
And this is something we need to pay increasing attention towards. Even though Russia readily admits that NATO, United States military, far superior, that doesn't deter them. They're going to find ways to be to matter, to influence, have access and influence the geopolitical matters that matter to them, especially with Eastern Europe. The Baltics, the Black Sea are key areas for them, as they have been for many, many years.
Well, that kerfuffle a few years ago in the Ukraine, was that kind of a telltale sign of what you're talking about?
Exactly, yes. That taught us a lot of lessons.
Yeah.
Very few people, if any, predicted that.
Yeah.
And we missed the ball on that one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
That was the annexation of Crimea was an absolute classic textbook example of unconventional warfare, something we've kind of forgotten about. Especially when we think about new types of warfare, asymmetric warfare, hybrid warfare, what do these things mean? How does it work? We saw an example, an absolute textbook example of unconventional warfare with Crimea, executed perfectly. Russia had prepared and conditioned the area for years in order to go in when they did, pull the trigger, and have overwhelming ability to achieve their goals rapidly. And what was key to them that we really need to pay attention to is how they went in and locked down everything that could potentially lead to a little bit of violence. So armories, weapons, all those stations, everything locked down, not a shot fired. That would have invoked an international response that could have been different had there been violence.
Mm-hmm.
Putin knew better and this is something he pays attention to very closely, is he does not want the international community meddling in his business. So he factors that into his strategies and plans. Crimea is a perfect example of this. Not a shot fired. Basically, we didn't see any type of violence that caused concern or would have justified international attention or interaction or intervention. And this is something I think we're going to see more and more in the future of how they operate and how they execute their strategic goals.
It's such a small, though, piece of property, important nonetheless, especially when you consider what the Soviet Union was previously and what Russia is now. So if he's nibbling off piece by piece in that dose, it would take forever. But do you see this as, what his end game is, his goal?
Exactly. Your point is well taken. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Raspad in Russian, they had lost about 20% of their real estate, mm-hmm. right? And this invoked a resurgence of what's kind of known as irredentist policies, the pursuit of regaining those lost territories that lost. And that's a very important part of Putin's goals. He has a couple of other larger concepts that he's trying to employ right now, such as a development of a superior Eurasian civilization in order to offer a better version than the decadent West Euro-Atlantic civilization, mm-hmm. hence the meddling in elections and making it look like democracy's messy, ineffective. This is a very, very long-term goal for Putin. But he potentially is going to be in power until 2036, so he gets to right. see this stuff go through. Crimea probably was more militarily, strategically important as a point on Earth for them because of the Black Sea, more than kind of just regaining lost territory. This was extremely important strategically for them to secure.
So in what ways can Russia's global ambitions be contained? I mean, you mentioned Crimea. They just walked in. Not a shot was fired. What can the West do to hold this in check?
Well, containment is going to be a challenge. That was our first policy post-World War II with Stalin, the containment policy following the famous George Kennan telegraph. Today, a lot of our concern involves stability in energy production and what Russia brings to that. And more importantly, how that influences Europe, because the amount of energy, oil and gas that Russia provides to Europe, mm-hmm. the United States looks to that as far as our key allies and alliances. What could go wrong there, especially? We saw that again with Crimea. Is this going to turn into an issue with Ukraine, which is a major corridor for the natural gas pipelines that do pipe into Europe? Was that going to cause an issue? And we learned basically, no, it wasn't. We also learned that Putin is smart enough to not use energy as a weapon, which a lot of people were concerned of.
Yeah.
In my own research, I've dug up evidence that indicates he will not use energy as a weapon in a punitive way. What he does do, like anyone else, is use energy to kind of shape and steer policy. But once it's in place, he knows it's too important to disrupt that in an important chain. Mm-hmm. With doesn't matter what state it is.
Yeah. All right, let's focus in on the Arctic. What do we know about Russia's intentions or ambitions pertaining to the Arctic?
Well, importantly, we were talking about gas and oil.
Yeah.
And the current legacy and current reserves that are in production right now, like Western Siberia, are reasonably understood to going to run out someday, right? There's an expected lifetime for those. And oil and gas have become incredibly important for the national budget of Russia. Sometimes up to 50% of their entire budget comes from oil and gas. So it's necessary to maintain that kind of revenue stream for years and years, and it takes a long time to get oil and gas projects online. A lot of initial exploration and deeper exploration, well development, production, those take years, and you want to keep that that revenue stream nice and smooth, mm-hmm. right? So the Arctic has become the place that's going to follow and replace the legacy wells that are drying up now in Russia. So the Western Reserves and others, Western Siberia, as those start to fade out, like Yusinsk and other places, the Arctic represents a large percentage of what will be the next, the future reserves that they need to get online and inject that revenue stream and keep things stable. So the Arctic is very important for that reason, and much of the development based on that, it kind of stems from that priority.
Well, Russia does have a large presence in the Arctic, so don't they have a legitimate claim to this region and those resources?
They have a legitimate claim, clearly, to their own sovereign territories, terrestrial, obviously. Maritime is the area where it's getting a little bit tricky. The Northern Sea Route, as it's defined by the Russian Federation, by federal law, is an area where we're seeing some issues. It's an area they defined from the coastline between Novaya Zemlya, this long banana-shaped type island, to Cape Dezhnev, right next to Alaska, all the way out to the extended economic zone boundary. It's 200 nautical miles from the coast as waters that they absolutely control. This is way, way beyond international norms. Normally, beyond 12 nautical miles, international waters, total access, freedom of nav, innocent passage, things like that are allowed in the maritime domain. Russia is attempting to, and currently controlling all of those waters out to 200 nautical miles. That is a huge problem for the United States and what we uphold as freedom of navigation principles around the world. In a maritime domain that's responsible for 90% plus of our economic activity, transportation, and 70% of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Troy, what is the Arctic Council?
The Arctic Council is the world's highest level forum for international forum for Arctic affairs. It was established in 1996 with the Ottawa Declaration, and the charter of the Arctic Council includes a requirement to not discuss military hard security issues as part of its agenda. So that has really allowed it to focus on its primary and legacy origins of focusing on the environment, identifying and tackling the most pressing issues, getting that sponsorship from the member nations to sponsor projects that affect these issues and work them through the working groups and try to deal with the most pressing issues as fast as possible. And because of the charter and the way it's organized, 8 member states, it's a little easier to get consensus agreement, which is required. All 8 member states must agree on any issues, and it's been able to really accomplish a lot.
Mm-hmm. All right, and why has Russia taken a more cooperative approach to the Arctic than it has in other parts of the world?
Russia, as a non-centrist state, has always followed an approach of international relations in a manner that's a little different than we do in liberal democratic nations. They can separate and do consistently keep issues separate from other issues. So with Crimea, there was the annexation of Crimea. There's a lot of concern. Okay, is this going to wreck our relationship in the Arctic and elsewhere, or Syria? And we often have to remind ourselves that Russia doesn't think that way. They can separate these issues. They're consistent, and it's genuine for them. Mm. I remember being at a meeting with the Chilingarov, who had been the individual that had planted the flag, the Russian flag, at the North Pole several years prior in 2007. And in front of us, at a meeting in 2014, right after Crimea, he had said, "Don't worry about that stuff. Let's be good partners in the Arctic still." And he was sincere, and most of the Westerners in the audience were like,
yeah,
appalled.
Right.
But that is the way they think, and they are consistent that way.
And what was the significance of them planting that flag on the North Pole? For them, at least.
It was. For them, it was a gesture, much like what we had to explain to the public that was extremely confused at the point. What did that mean? for us, we basically said it's the same thing exactly as us, the United States planting the flag on the moon. Right? Mm-hmm. It's nothing official. It's symbolic. But what it did is it sparked discussion in combination with the USGS report that came out about the amount of oil and gas in the Arctic at the same time and the reports with the receding sea ice. Now the attention on the Arctic started, and it was pretty intense. And from that point on, the Arctic's never been the same.
Mm. Now, you said the Arctic Council doesn't get involved with military issues. Are we seeing a buildup of security forces in the Arctic by either NATO or Russia or both?
Russia especially, yes.
Yeah.
So they've revitalized numerous, almost a dozen stations along the coast. Largely in accordance with their official statements to support the Northern Sea Route, right, and have the kind of operational support and emergency support that they need along a coastline that long. And these are largely dual-use stations, emergency use as well as military runways and ports. And aside from that, there's a bastion defense that they've developed along the coast also with very advanced short-range missiles, S-400s, further out on the islands like Novaya Zemlya, Franz Josef Island, Kotelny, and others. They put most of their advanced sensors out there also. And it's kind of important. Alaska has no islands off our north coast. And those forward positions for sensors are a unique advantage, and Russia has taken full advantage of that.
Boy, as you you map this out, it really it makes old Sword, Sword's Folly, the purchase of Alaska, so vitally important. Who could have guessed that, 150 years later or whatever it is now, that was really important for. I probably have the calculation of time wrong as when we purchased Alaska.
It was 1867,
oh, okay.
And General Billy Mitchell at the time in the early 1900s had mentioned that Alaska is the most strategic place on the planet.
Mm. Wow, that's a great bit of history. So let's talk about we have a few more minutes, but as you see it, the strategic importance of the Arctic as we know it today.
Strategic importance is what we're learning, especially with COP26 going on and the IPCC recent report coming out. It's the most seminal collection of understanding climate change, is the Arctic represents kind of the bellwether, canary in the coal mine, of what to expect from climate change. It's going to happen first, and it's going to happen most intensely in the Arctic. Arctic amplification and the way that the Earth's climate systems work converge in the Arctic. So we're going to learn about impacts from climate change in the Arctic first. Right? It's a warning that the world should pay attention to. And the efforts that happen there, with receding sea ice, there's a concern there will be more maritime activity, so the response to that is part of the operational buildup and concern even for the United States and how that will occur. Mostly the intent is benign and economic in as far as goals and motivations. And still to this day, with Russia as a member of the Arctic Council, one of the five littoral nations with sovereign territory in the Arctic, the other four being founding members of NATO, Russia is a pretty solid partner in the Arctic. They understand, like we all do, as Arctic nations, you got to work together. It's too difficult, it's too expensive, too technical to try to do anything alone in the Arctic. And even Russia gets this. And we all need to study the climate. We need to understand our ecosystem. Together, it's going to take all hands on deck, so to say, to understand this. So we can expect Russia to continue to be consistent. If for anything, it's very convenient for them, especially when the Arctic Council doesn't discuss security issues like that. That could be a deal breaker. So it's very convenient. It works for them. There's genuine need to do so, and they want to be part of that. And they've been good members. So there's no other arrangement like this in the world. When you have five sovereign states that have extra jurisdiction and authority in the north like that, four of them being founding members of NATO, the other Russia. There's no other arrangement like this on the planet right now that involves Russia.
You sound somewhat optimistic that they will do the right thing, that they can separate what that aggression that they're showing in some spots in the world and what they're doing.
They're very consistent that way.
Yeah.
There is posturing and a little bit of frustration about who's building up what military and what, you know, and activities, military activities in the north, all pretty manageable. It will become more manageable when we're legally allowed to have mill-to-mill contact with Russia again to start talks. Right now that's off the table. Still manageable. We have no foreseeable indications of any conflict in the Arctic over Arctic issues. Stuff may spill into it, but for the most part, everything seems very manageable right now.
It's good to hear. Troy Bouffard is the director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Center for Arctic Security and Resilience, one of the featured speakers at Norwich University's Military Writers Symposium. Troy, this has really been enlightening. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Many thanks for production assistance to Daphne Larkin and also engineering assistance from Steve Cormier. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading the podcast at wdevradio.com. The podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world-famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.